stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm playing an interview that I did with Will Willoughby, who is stage manager for Savannah Disputation, the play currently running at Florida Studio Theater in Sarasota, Florida. If you were listening last week, you heard the interviews I did with Lisa McMillan and Susan Greenhill, who are two of the four cast members of Savannah Disputation. I like to promote, whenever possible, the good work that's being done in Sarasota. And Savannah Disputation is a wonderful play. And I am grateful to be able to have had the interviews with Lisa and Susan, and now to have the interview with Will Willoughby, to give you another opportunity to hear about and maybe come down and see Savannah Disputation. As I say in the beginning of the show, and also in the beginning of my interview with Will, he's the very first stage manager that I have ever interviewed. And so we get an opportunity to get a glimpse into what it means to be a stage manager. But this interview is important to me for other reasons, and I will talk about that at length at the beginning of the show. So hang on. Here comes the show.
An inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can.
Hello, and welcome to The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is about being you, being the real you. If you've been listening, you know I say every week some variation on this theme, the idea that we come out of childhood with a version of ourselves that we believe in, which, although it is clearly the truth, is usually, often, mostly, dare I say, always, not the whole truth. That there are things about us which we manage to forget. Of course, the psychotherapeutic term for that is denial. And I believe, as a therapist, that all of us are, to some extent, in denial for some aspects of ourselves. Something about us needed to be hidden in order to successfully navigate the family into which we were born, or the school into which we had to go, or the friends that we had to accommodate. We got the idea that there were things about us that did not go down well, that would cost us attention, affection, safety sometimes. And as a result, we figured out how first to pretend that these things were not true, and then we got so good at pretending that we forgot ourselves. I have written a book about this. It's called When You Can, You Will: Why You Can't Always Do What You Want to Do and What to Do About It. And in the book, again, if you've been listening, you've heard me say this many times, I talk about the person that we demonstrate, that we present to the world. I call that our cover story. Just like a spy, we have a cover story. And just like a spy, we use that cover story because in order to tell the whole truth, we think that that would get us into trouble. The difference between us and the spy is the spy knows that it's false. And by the time we come out of childhood, we've forgotten that it's false. And we believe our own cover story. Undercover, as I call in the book, we have qualities which we have hidden away. And it is also my belief that we need those qualities later in life. We come to need those qualities, and the irony is that quite often people come into therapy wanting to be able to do something or be something that they already are, but they forgot. They have that quality, that behavior, that way of being undercover. I talk in the book a lot about the fact of the cover story and the undercover, how you can demonstrate for yourself that that quality does actually belong to you, and how you can recover that quality if you find that you need it later in life. The other thing I do in my show is that I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. And I do that because we make it so hard for artists in this culture that no one who wasn't really that could sustain it. And I always say that when you listen to the people that I interview, the musicians, the writers, the directors, the actors, you hear what we therapists call congruence. That is, you hear that they really are who they are. Today's interview is with a stage manager, and as I tell him towards the beginning of the interview, he's the very first stage manager that I have interviewed, and so we spend a lot of the first part of the interview with his describing to me what a stage manager does, which I really didn't know, and which I found really interesting. But the most interesting part, for me anyway, of this interview with Will Willoughby is his, what he calls his integrity, what I would have called psychotherapeutically his congruence, his fierce determination not to deny himself, to be himself. And that self cost him big time through virtually his entire childhood and beyond. I'm going to let Will tell the story. But I also need to apologize. I have these technological deficiencies. And I interviewed Will in my home. He came here for me to interview him. And because I cannot make the phone, the ring on the phone, not make noise, about 13 minutes into the interview, the phone rang. I turned off my little recorder and forgot to turn it back on. And I don't know how many minutes later, I realized that I hadn't turned it back on. And so I turned it back on and I attempted to recap the most, really, the most powerful information that I got in that time that I wasn't recording. I tried to recap it. As I have listened to the interview, I realized that I left out some important things. So when we get to the place where the phone rang, I'm going to stop the interview and catch you up on some of the things that were said and then pick up the interview again. Fortunately, I haven't had to do this very often. But it's really worth it. Will's story is amazing and very powerful, and for me, makes the point of how significant, important, and I cannot stress it enough, it really is to know who you are and to honor who you are so that you can have the life that really fits you. And Will Willoughby is somebody who did that. And it is his strength of character and what he calls his commitment to integrity. So I'm going to let you hear the story mostly from Will's own lips. And here he is, Will Willoughby.
All right, so I'm here with Will Willoughby, and he is currently the stage manager for the FST production of Savannah Disputation.
Yes.
Yes. So I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. Now, what it sounds like is that you have made your life with theater.
Mm-hmm. I started out as an actor. That's how I got my union card.
Uh-huh.
When I came to FST, and you know, I had my equity card and had a lot of experience working in theater. I'd been an artistic director for a little theater Venice, California. I'd worked both, you know, in front of the scenes and behind the scenes, and so it was just, you know, sort of one of those things that we do, and I wanted the opportunity to stage manage, and Richard gave me the opportunity to stage manage, and I loved it, you know. I loved doing it. I loved, you know, being a part of the show and working with the actors, and so I did. My first show was Sylvia at FST, and then I did I Love You, You're Perfect, Now Change. Mm-hmm. And then I did Race, and...
Oh, my goodness. You know, I interviewed Gil, and I interviewed Kevin, both for those two productions. They were wonderful
shows.
They were. Oh, my
wonderful.
God, they were wonderful.
And I Love You, You're Perfect, Now Change was my most difficult show to call as a stage manager. Because
well, I want to stop you for a second, because you're the first stage manager I have interviewed.
Oh.
So would you tell me and the audience what a stage manager does?
Well, a stage manager is involved with the production from the beginning of rehearsal, from the first day of rehearsal through the final curtain of the show. Mm. So you're in rehearsal. You are playing two roles. You're the advocate for the actors because you're the same union. You're in the same union.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, the actors union and the stage manager. You're in the same union.
So if you're an actor and you have your equity card as an actor, does that mean you can also be a stage manager, or do you need to have...
No, you can be a stage manager.
That's okay.
You
I got
can
it.
Be a stage manager. Right. If you're a member of Actors Equity, you can.
Stage
be,
manager.
Yeah.
Great. Okay, good. So then you're somebody who really has is simpatico to the needs of the actor.
Well, yeah, and a lot of stage managers have had actor training, and that's important because once the show is out of rehearsal and onto the stage, you become the director of the show, basically. You make sure that they're still doing and making sure that the show is growing and they're keeping with their blocking. And
okay, let me stop you again.
All of that.
Because so this is how I understand what you're saying. The director directs the production from day one through opening night.
Right.
But then they leave.
Then they leave.
And then there's the stage manager.
That's right.
Oh, wow.
That's right.
I don't think I ever knew that.
Yeah, and then the stage manager is there to watch the performances, you know, watch the show, and call the show as well.
Call the show.
Call the show means you start calling the show at half hour, which is half hour before curtain.
Right. Half hour, everybody.
Half hour. And you give the actors backstage their calls, and you let them know, okay, it's half hour, 15 minutes, 10 minutes, 5 minutes, places. Places is 2 minutes before the show.
Mm-hmm.
And then everyone, you know, the actors move to places, and you move to your place in the booth, and, you know, in some shows, especially, I mean, like bigger Broadway shows, the stage manager actually calls the show, which is they have a prompt book, and
they call the lights and all that.
But since, you know, it's like a show like Savannah, there's not a lot of light cues, there's not a lot of sound cues, so I actually do the lights and the sound myself.
Oh!
So I'm doing lights and sound, and I'm calling those cues and watching the show and making sure when the BlackBerry goes off, the sound cue goes off. When the answering machine, you know, messages erase, that sound cue goes and those lights go. And the lights go off and on, you know, when they're supposed to. And that's called a prompt book, the stage manager's prompt book. And it has all of your light and sound cues.
You know what this reminds me of? It's an absurd association, but umpires at a, and it's not umpires, but linesmen at a tennis match. I mean, you can't take your eyes off it for a second.
Right.
Right?
Right.
Right. That's, wow. So it requires so many things. I mean, not only the knowledge of acting and mm-hmm. when people are doing it right and not, or when they're getting stale or when they're growing or all that stuff mm-hmm. that's related mm-hmm. to acting. Mm-hmm. But there's the details and the skill of the light board and the sound cues mm-hmm. and all that. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a very, mm-hmm. right. And in addition to that, there's this thing that I'm alluding to, which is the capacity to concentrate, to focus. Mm-hmm. If you have ADD, you can't do this job.
I don't know. I mean, I'm sure.
Well, I would think, I mean, really.
But you gotta stick with it. You have to be there. It's almost like you're on stage with the actors.
Right.
It's very much like that. You're there.
You're
with
focused
them.
Completely
every
on
every breath, every movement.
Wow.
You know, every cross, every moment in the show, and that's also one of the things that a good stage manager does is there to reassure the actors that yes, they did a great job tonight.
Yeah.
Or.
And do you give notes? That was the other question.
You give notes. You know, sometimes one day an actor will forget a line.
Yeah, right.
That happens all the time. And if it happens once, no. You don't give a note
right,
on that.
No.
If it happens twice, you go, maybe I better watch that. If it happens a third time, you know, somehow that got deleted.
Right.
And then you go, you know, you...
Have you... did you notice?
You've deleted that line, or mm-hmm. you know, that moment's gone, or, right. you know, stuff right. like that. And so, because it's really to maintain the integrity of the show as it was directed.
Yes. And theoretically, the actors believe that you're an advocate.
Well, you are the actor's advocate. You are the person they can come to.
Right.
The actors themselves have elected amongst them a deputy who is the representative of the actor, who would then, if they have, you know, some issue or some difficulty or even some good thing, they'll come to you and say, okay, listen, this is what's, you know, going on. And,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. So I'm curious, why was I Love You, You're Perfect Now Changed so difficult?
Because there were so many cues.
Oh.
There were so many cues, and it was a musical.
Yes.
And so
oh,
there
yes,
were
right.
two spotlights, and there were a lot of sound cues. And you had the
and did you
orchestra.
Run them as well?
I ran the light board itself, but I called the rest of the show.
Wow.
So I had somebody up in the booth who was running the sound, and then all of the actors had body mics.
Right.
And those mics had to be...
Turned on and off?
Yeah, when Woo! They... We can't have
yeah,
it
right,
on,
no,
on
right.
when they're off stage.
Right, right, right.
Those had to be on and off, and levels had to be set. You know, one day somebody might be a little louder or softer than they are
yes.
on another day, so those levels had to be adjusted constantly during the show. There's a set level where people were at, but one day they might just be a little lower.
Yeah, and if you're paying attention, you know that.
You can go, oh, you better bring so-and-so up, or you better bring so-and-so down, or, you know, or the mics, you know, body mics are, they're little devices, and they have a little plug, just like you plug into for your headphones.
Right.
You know, and sometimes they can have issues.
Yes, yeah, right, right. They can not work as well,
yeah.
or they can, the battery can
or
go off,
or
whatever it is, right?
Get staticky, or feedback.
Right, you know, right, right, right.
All
right.
kinds of stuff, and those are problems that you have to solve on the spot so that the show isn't suffering because of it, you know, and the audience is getting, you know, the full experience of the show.
Wow.
And then you have to call the spotlights for the musical numbers. You have to, you know.
I don't remember. Was there live music?
Yeah, there was an orchestra. There
right.
was a piano.
And, right,
and so all of those people you had to were on call at half hour as well, so you had to make sure everybody was in
place.
Oh,
God, right,
and everybody,
right. And they all are mic'd or not, right?
I mean, they're mic'd as well.
Though. Right.
And that show also had a big running crew. There were 6 people backstage because there were so many scenes in I Love
right.
You, You're Perfect Now, Change,
right.
that things had to come on and
off and
on
yeah,
and
right,
off.
Right.
And you had to have a lot of people doing
yeah.
stuff.
Wow.
To make sure that it all happened. So that was the most challenging.
Yeah, this is harder than the tennis match. Because there are so many things going on.
There are a lot of moving
and you
parts.
Can't, right, and you can't miss any of them.
And then that the stage manager is, when it says stage manager, you're responsible for the stage.
What does that mean?
That means the stage is in the house.
Yeah.
Where the audience sits. So that means you need to be aware of the air conditioning, the temperature.
Oh my goodness.
All of those things. If the house is too warm, if the house is too... You have to be in touch with the front of house to make sure, what can we do to cool it off? What can we do to, you know... And when you have a lot of lights going in the theater, it can get... So you really have to make sure you're aware of those things.
So, did you have training for this?
I've been in the theater for 20 years,
So you're saying no. I mean, you're saying that your life in the theater was the training.
Well, and then there is a stage manager who's been at FST for a number of years, Callie Karen,
mm-hmm.
and she, you know, really helped me and led me through a lot of the things that I needed to do. And so, yeah, she did train me.
Yeah.
She did train me for the job.
Right. But you have to have, you have to come in with so much information. You have to know maybe you don't know about the heat in the building or whatever, you know.
Are things you have to learn.
You have
about
to learn, right. But about
theater.
Acting and about when the show is going well and when people forget what they're doing and that the cues have to go on. And you have to pretty much come in with that.
Yeah.
You know, right.
Yeah.
So well, thank you very much for the short course in
yeah.
stage management. That's great. So I always ask people the same question. As I said, I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. And the question I always ask is, how did it happen? When was the very first moment in your life when you thought or knew that acting or theater or performance was for you? That this is what you either wanted to do or were good at or drawn to, or somebody said, you know, oh, he's so talented or whatever. Do you know what I'm asking?
Mm-hmm.
Do you know?
I grew up in Nebraska. I grew up in a small town in Nebraska.
Mm-hmm.
And I was different than my other schoolmates.
Uh-huh.
I was a different kind of boy.
Mm-hmm.
Remarkably, this is where the phone rang. And it's in the next, I don't know how many minutes before I figured it out and turned the recorder back on, that Will tells me that when he came out about his gayness at 16, when he told his family that he was gay, that they told him that he could live in the house until he was 18 and graduated from high school, but then he had to leave and they didn't want to see him ever again. And in fact, that is what happened. He will make reference to this later in the interview, so I'm not going to say much more about it, except that is what happened, that is how it happened. Also, he talks about the fact that he had a relationship with his oldest sister, the oldest child in the family, until her death. And when right before she died, she spoke to the next sister down to tell her that she was missing out on an important relationship with Will, but by that time so much water had been under that bridge that they really couldn't sustain a relationship. That's pretty much everything else I think is explained in the rest of the interview, but these what I consider to be really significant pieces of information didn't actually get said. So here I'm going to pick up the interview with Will again and let you hear the rest of his story.
Difficult as your early life must have been, and actually now I want to ask a question. The you were saying, and I wasn't recording when you said it, that that you came out of the closet and admitted to your gayness to your family when you were 16.
Yes.
Right. Now, was the theater class before that or after that? Did you?
Around the same time.
Around the same time. So I'm wondering, because what you said, which we didn't get, is that you found your home, you found a place, you found an identity in and an acceptance in the theater mm-hmm. community of your high school. So I'm wondering, and I cannot make this larger than I mean, it's so important to me that that even though one can have had a childhood in which one feels like a misfit, in which one is treated unkindly and cruelly, and even one's family doesn't feel like a part, it's not too late to find a place where your identity is reinforced, where you feel like, this is who I am.
Everybody belongs in the theater.
Everybody belongs in the theater. Are you listening?
Everybody belongs.
Right.
Everybody belongs, no matter what, no matter who, no matter how, no matter... Everyone belongs.
The theater and makes even, a place for them.
Even the audience, especially at FST, everyone belongs there. That's one of the great things that they have done at Florida Studio Theater, is to make theater accessible to
right.
all.
Right, right, right.
Okay. Everyone belongs.
So, do you remember whether... you had found this before you were able to tell your family the truth about yourself?
No, what happened, I mean, it's almost like the story of Katharine Hepburn, the thing, the transformational thing in her life when her brother committed suicide.
Yes.
My best friend in high school was so made fun of and tortured and because he was gay.
And because it was apparent, or because
yeah,
he said?
Yeah, he was, I mean, yeah.
Okay.
I mean, and he was my best friend.
Right.
And
so did everyone know you were gay as well, or did they just assume it, or did they just?
They knew.
Yeah.
And I was tortured too, but he, for some reason, he couldn't take it, and he took a shotgun and put it in his mouth and blew his head off.
Oh, well, that will change everything.
And I said, nobody is going to do that to me.
Right.
And I said, I am who I am, I don't... You know what, and that's it. And the one place where I could be who I was
right.
was in the theater, because there's all kinds of people in the theater. They come from all walks of life.
Right.
You
right.
know? And that's where I found my family. That's where I found my acceptance. That's where I found my value.
And your identity.
My identity.
Yeah, your identity as more than simply somebody who doesn't fit in with the rest of these people. So was it after his suicide that you came out to your family?
That was a real... Because I was afraid. You know, I was afraid. And I was really going to them as a cry for help.
Wow.
And when I got shut down there, I mean, it's not like anything you get over right away. I mean, I'm almost 45 years old.
Right, right.
I've been through a lot of therapy.
Yeah, right. I'm sure you have. But what I am wondering at, and just so impressed, I think it's not really the right word, but that there was in you the unwillingness to succumb. However much you struggled, however much therapy you had to get to deal with it, however much darkness there was, and I imagine there was quite a lot, something inside of you said, I will survive. I'll find a way to be okay. And you didn't get that from your family unless, I mean, is there a very strong sort of survivor thing in your family that you got even though you didn't get the rest of it? Do you know what I mean?
Well, my mother's side of the family is, you know, old German stock.
Right.
My grandma lived to be 103 years old and drove her car till she was 85.
Yeah, right, okay.
You know.
So there is that through line from your family that we are strong, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right. So it's kind of ironic that you got that. I mean, your friend didn't get that.
No.
Right? But you did.
Not everybody has a survivor mentality. Not everybody does.
I know it.
And it's not even just a mentality. It's an inner strength to look at your circumstances and look at yourself in your circumstances and go, okay, how do I get through this?
Yes.
How do I get through it?
You know, I think it's an inner certainty that you deserve to get through it. You know, because...
Mm, yeah.
Do you understand what I'm saying?
I do.
Yeah. And awful as I think your family was, I suspect you got that from them. It's insidious, but that's not what I mean.
Well, they were a depression family.
Mm-hmm. And they survived.
They were a depression family with, you know, my father, you know, they had a big farm and everything else, and the banks took it and they lost everything. And, you know, 11 kids living in a train car.
Right.
You know, trying to get enough food to eat. And they were a depression family. And they all survived it. And it could be the Willoughby side of my family, my father's side, as much too, because they are, you know, very, very much survivors, all of them, survivors and independent.
Yeah. So it's an interesting, you are an interesting dichotomy coming out of that family. You are not anything like any of them, and yet you got this iron certainty that, I mean, truly, you know, if even your family turns their back on you by the time you're 16, it takes a very, very something, which you clearly have.
And then it's not just that. I mean, it's also when those things happen to not become embittered by life,
yes.
To not become, you know, angry at life, to maintain your joy. And that, all of that I got from Jerome Lawrence. You know,
okay, now I want to go there because that's... So tell me... So I just want to run through it. So you find theater at around 15, 16. You say, oh my God, here I am. This is me. Then you do the ballet thing. I don't know whether we got that or not, so I'm going to recap it. You take ballet lessons with some of the... And some of the girls, including the most popular girl in school, is in your ballet class. And then you have the amazing courage... to dance, did you say Cinderella?
Cinderella. I was the lead cavalier.
The lead cavalier in front of the entire school in the gymnasium, mm-hmm. Demonstrating...
In tights and ballet shoes.
In tights and ballet shoes, demonstrating, this is who I am, and this is who I am. And ironically, because you dance with the most popular girl in school...
I get popular for the last 3 months of high school.
You get popular for the last 3 months of high school, but... That experience, it seems to me, says to you, and if I am true to myself, things will work out. If I honor myself, it'll be okay. Because that's what happened. You did that. And they weren't wrong about you being brave. You were. So, okay, so then you're 18?
I got accepted to a school in Cedar Falls, Iowa, University of Northern Iowa. Went in and auditioned for the plays, was going to be a theater major.
Right.
Got cast in the lead, in the Seagull, Treplow.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a very much of an organic acting experience where we actually like took a weekend and went out to a park and recreated the whole scene. We were in cabins together. We sat around a campfire. Recreated the whole scene of this whole Russian country life and doing this play outside and the whole thing. And I stayed there for 2 years, and I decided I was wasting money and time, and I left for Dallas, and just decided I was going to be an actor and all of that kind of stuff. And my sister, my oldest sister, was there, and I lived with her, and that's where we did have that bond. And when I was there, I got accepted to the American Academy of Dramatic Arts. They were doing auditions, and I accepted Pasadena, and I moved to California. And a little blip of fate is what actually ended up getting me introduced to Jerome Lawrence.
What was it?
I was working at a restaurant as a waiter, mm-hmm. to make money, to go off to California. And
oh, you were still in Texas?
I was in Texas, and these guys I was waiting on one day took a very good shine to me, and you know, I wanted to know my story, and I was, you know, going off, you know, to California and everything else, invited me to a dinner party, went to a dinner party, and for the next few months, invited me over for dinner and everything else, and as, like, the week before I was getting ready to leave, he said, I just want you to know, his name was Buddy Ross, and he said, I just want you to know I've done something, and I was like, what have you done? And he goes, I wrote a letter. His uncle in California was Jerome Lawrence's next-door neighbor. And he knew Jerome Lawrence, and he wrote Jerome Lawrence a letter on my behalf, saying there's this very nice young man coming to California. I don't want him to get eaten alive. Everybody needs help in the theater. Can I give him your name and phone number? And Jerry wrote back and put in his card and said, yes, yes, please do. Have him call me when he gets to California.
I have tears in my eyes.
And
that was so sweet.
And, you know, I eventually did. I was nervous, but I eventually called him. And he had me meet him and Bob Lee at Samuel French Bookstore in Hollywood, I guess, to make sure I wasn't...
You were okay, right.
Crazy, meet in a public place.
Right.
And in him and Bob Lee and Bob's wife, Janet, who was the voice of Judy Jetson and Penelope Pitstop, were there reading from their plays at Samuel French on a day against banning books in high school.
Really?
And Jerry was standing up there doing a speech from the night Thoreau spent in jail, and I would see him do the speech many times over the year, but the end of the speech, he would go around and point at everyone in the audience. The very end of the speech is, I want each and every one of you to be your own person.
Oh, God.
And, you know, it. And I started working for him on the weekends, and then I eventually started working for him full time. And, you know, this is, you know, the guy who wrote Live, 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 Life is a Banquet, and most poor suckers are starving
to death.
And he just instilled it in me.
It's so brilliant, oh my God.
He instilled it in me.
Live, live, live.
Every day. Live, live, live. And he said, if you don't believe it, let me believe it for you until you can believe it yourself.
Wow. Well, life seems to have handed you a very interesting combination of experiences, doesn't it?
You can say that.
I mean, really, you get both ends of the continuum here.
Well, but then, you see, the thing was, and then I went to work for some very wealthy people after Jerome Lawrence passed away, and, you know, God, I thought every dream I wanted to ever have, working on Broadway, my name in a Broadway playbill, you know, everything that I could ever want, and I grew continually unhappy, because it's not ever what I dreamed. It's just a whole different world. That commercial Broadway theater world is a whole different cutthroat, backstabbing environment.
It's not the family of theater.
It's not.
No.
And I took a long time after that. I was in that job for 4 years. And I mean, it was a great job. I was traveling back and forth, traveling all over the country. It's a great job. And I took a long time. And when I came down here, when they brought me down here to interview, and I met Richard, and I saw the theater, and I saw what was going on here, and we talked. And I was like, wow, this could be a home.
Yeah.
I was like, wow.
Yet again.
This could be a home. And he said, well, you know, we may never do anything here that goes to Broadway. Is that important to you? I said, if I never see Broadway again. You know, the only way I would ever do it is if I came. Sometimes shows do go to Broadway, and it's a family of people who've gotten together, who've made this show happen, and they all stick together, and they don't throw each other away as the success happens.
Right.
But most of the time, as the success starts to happen on a show, people get tossed aside.
Right.
They get,
because they want names, and they get, but
there are shows that have happened, and that all those people go together, and they fight for each other, and they get to have that experience together as a family that created that show.
Right.
And I said, well, I would do that. I would do that.
Yeah, right.
But I wouldn't want to go back to that kind of stress and need for success, because success is measured...
At whatever cost, right?
Yeah, and success... that is measured at FST is success measured in, are we reaching our audience? Are we serving our community?
Right.
And are we Are we doing the best that we can?
And is this quality?
And it's always striving for quality.
Right.
I mean, and the interns and the young people that come to the theater get the experience of working in a theater and working with professionals, and you get to nurture them, you know. You get to have, you know, I sort of play the wacky uncle role, you know.
But you get to give back what you got.
Yeah.
You know, which is to welcome these people who may or may not fit anywhere else.
Yeah.
And tell them that there's a family for them.
Yeah.
It's wonderful.
Yeah, and it is. When I got here, it took me a little while to really see. But then once I got into the rehearsal room and I saw what was going on in rehearsal with the actors and the process and really, you know, focusing on finding the truth, you know, finding the truth in the play, finding the truth in the character, and bringing that truth to the stage and giving it to the audience. And I was like,
this is the art to which you wanted to give your life.
This is what, when I was 16 years old and had all of those problems and things going on, this is the kind of place that I dreamed existed. With Jerry, it was a young man, and he was Uncle Mame opening doors for me, doors I never even dreamed existed.
Yeah, Patrick.
Yeah, I was little Patrick.
Patrick to his, to his Jerry, right?
I was his little Patrick.
Yeah, it's lovely.
And it just was door after door after door. I didn't even have time to think about that initial dream that I'd had of what a theater was, you know, a place where magic happened.
Yes.
A place where you could actually do magic, and magic is, you know, one of the things we have in our mission at FST is we challenge with as much gusto as we entertain.
Yes.
You know, and when you challenge and a person thinks differently about their life or themselves in their life or their neighbor or the person or their government or their
society,
and there's a light that goes on, that's magic. That's magic.
Yeah, it's the theater can be, although it isn't always, a vehicle for having an impact on the audience, right? It isn't always,
and on people's lives.
And well, that's what I mean.
Yeah.
You know, that it actually makes a difference.
There's a song from one of Jerry's musicals that he wrote with Jerome Lawrence wrote two musicals with Jerry Herman, Mame and Dear World.
Mm-hmm.
And Dear World is based on the Map Woman of Shio.
Yes.
And there's a great song in there, which is one person can beat a drum and make enough noise for 10. And it's basically one person can change the world. And if you change the way one person thinks about their society, thinks about the world, that one person then can change another person and can change another person. And you're affecting change.
Yes, you are. And
that's what I believe is happening at FST. Both, you know, in the serious work that goes on there as well as the dramatic, and to be in the stage management and to be part of it and to see the audiences every night, to hear them every night, that's a great gift.
Well, my goodness. Okay, so I think actually you are answering my next question. In a way, you've been answering it all along. And that is... first of all, I always ask if there's anything I didn't ask that I should have.
Not that I know.
Nothing came to mind. Okay, good. And the other thing is, having given a life, and you have given a life in one way or another to the theater, right?
Mm-hmm.
So would you just think for a second and say... anything that comes to mind about that, what that's like, what you would want to say about it.
It's made me a better human being.
Could you say how?
When you get to be a part of different plays and the ideas of those plays and the ideas of those writers, and those ideas are life-changing ideas, and you get to be a part of them all the time, you think differently about yourself in the world. You think differently about people in the world. You become, at least for me, and I'm not saying everybody, but for myself, you become much more forgiving of the world. You work to be forgiving. You're not just forgiving. You right. work
right.
at being forgiving.
Well, you see being forgiving as a value.
You work at understanding. You work at what you don't understand.
Not everybody makes that leap, that I ought to be trying to be forgiving. Not everybody makes that leap. Mm-hmm.
You got to. If you want to be a real decent human being, you can sit in unforgiveness, you can sit in bitterness, you can sit in misunderstanding, and you can just go down into a really dark place. And I don't want to live in a really dark place. Life is a banquet. You can't live a banquet in a dark place.
You wouldn't see what to eat.
You can't. No. I mean, you have moments when you're there. You have moments, but you know, working on having an open mind and open thoughts, you go, okay, where do we need to get to? How can I put myself in the other person's shoes? You know, what can I do to understand and to get out of my own way, to get away from myself, to get away from my own feelings of being misunderstood or hurt or whatever it is, and go, okay, that's where it is. And then you go with forgiveness of self first, forgiveness of others. You can't forgive others unless you can forgive yourself. And I wouldn't know any of those things if I weren't in the theater.
I find myself thinking, well, first of all, that what you're describing is the best kind of education. The education that educates your mind and your heart and your psyche and your soul and everything. You know, I mean, it's not like, you know, anyway, I've said it, right? It's my idea of the quintessential education is what you're describing. But the other thing I find myself thinking is, how remarkable it is that your family, so rigid, so with blinders, created you. It's just amazing. That you came out
but they
of
did,
that.
But they did very good things for me, especially as a young child. And they instilled a sense of right and wrong in me.
Yes.
They instilled a sense of integrity in me. Integrity is the one thing I have.
Yes.
It's the only thing that I think anybody can carry through life that makes the difference is your own personal integrity. And my judgment can change. You know, as my life changes, oh, you know, that was an old idea. That was an old idea that served then. It doesn't serve anymore because you're at a different place. You've grown from that place. So there's more awareness and more acceptance.
So again, I want to say that it's remarkable to me. I mean, I think you're absolutely right that you got from your family the importance of integrity.
Core values.
Core values, absolutely.
Core values.
Right. And I think that is the truth and wonderful. And also, I'm sorry for them because...
They missed out.
They did. They absolutely missed out. They absolutely missed out. You're so wonderful. And they could have enjoyed you and everything that you could have brought to them. But never mind, they gave you to us. And that's, you know, okay.
And I've gone through the forgiveness of that.
Yeah, I believe you.
And what I have is, I mean, yes, I missed out too. I missed out on all of those things. Yes. But I made an attempt.
Right.
I attempted and attempted and attempted. And at a certain point... You have to go, okay, I can't attempt anymore.
Yeah. It's not there to be gotten.
Yeah.
Right, it's not there. And you got from where you put your life and your energy, you got a lot of the things back that one would get from a family of origin. Because the theater can do that.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Right. Okay.
And right now, I mean, I grew up in a Catholic family.
Oh, and well, Savannah Disputation.
Savannah Disputation and all of the things that come up in there.
Oh, talk a little bit about it. We haven't talked about it at all.
Well, I mean, it's just this wonderful, wonderful play that brings up the issues of, you know, religion.
Mm-hmm.
It's definitely about religion. And it's really how people do not understand each other and don't hear each other. And don't even know what...
They don't even hear themselves, given the scene where they do the...
They don't know what they believe themselves.
Yeah, right.
And I mean, well, I grew up Catholic, and I grew up with a professional... And there were things in the play that I was like, oh my God, and I went to Catholic grade school, I went to Catholic high school, and I still didn't know that's what I believed.
Right, and what I was saying, right,
I was
my
like,
God.
Oh my God, and then I was like, oh my, you know.
Yeah.
So it really is interesting, you know, in that respect, to have, see, that's what I mean, I get the opportunity to experience that language, those ideas, and to reflect on them and to have a deeper understanding of them.
Yes.
And that's the gift of the theater. That is the, and this production is beautiful. I mean, the performers are absolutely...
They're perfect.
They really are beautiful.
Yeah, they're perfect. Savannah Disputation is running until...
We're running through September 4th.
Right, so there will be time...
To come see the show. It's a great show, and it's very funny.
Yeah. Oh, it's hilarious.
It's very,
it
very
is
fun.
Hilarious, and at the same time, as it is so serious. Well, I mean, really, that line to be so serious and so funny at the same time, it's a beautifully written piece.
Jerry and Bob always used to say about their plays, you know, they wanted to make their funny plays serious and their serious plays funny.
Oh, how clever.
Because it's a little thing. The humor helps you understand the seriousness, and the seriousness, that the humor also gives you a release for it, so
right,
that you can really... It becomes a more well-crafted piece of theater.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I don't know if you got a chance to hear Susan and Lisa's interview.
Mm-hmm.
And they are not only amazing in the show, but they're so open, like you, you know.
You can't be in the theater if you're not open. That is.
I think that's right. You can't be any good in the theater if you're not open.
And that's what everyone trains and trains and trains and
right,
trains for.
Right.
So that, because especially as actors, as performers, they have to be open and vulnerable, so that those true emotions are there, so that true feeling is there, because that's the only way the audience is going to have an experience.
That's right. So, okay, I think this is a good place to stop. Thank you so much, Will.
Thank you.
This was great.
So, okay, there you have it. The poster child, essentially, for what I'm trying to do with this show. It's so interesting to me because, as I pointed out in the interview with Will, Susan and Lisa and he demonstrate so clearly what it means to really be yourself. And in Will's case, to be himself meant for so long in his life to be at odds with the people who he spent his life with, the people he had every right to believe would be his advocates. And they were, in fact, his tormentors and his betrayers. And to have been able to maintain what he's calling integrity, what, as a therapist, I would call congruence, the sense that this is who I am. You like it, you accept it, you understand it, or you don't. That doesn't impact the reality that this is who I am and this is who I will be. And because he was able, and I do credit his family's core values, that ironically they gave him that, to make him able to stand up to even them. That's an interesting and ironic twist of fate, I think. But because he had that, he was able to become the man you hear. Someone who found a mentor who could offer joy, who could offer acceptance, who could open the doors to live. I don't remember if I actually say in this interview that Auntie Mame, from which this line comes, you know, live, life's a banquet and most poor suckers are starving to death. That is one of my favorite films. The idea that one can and should embrace life right now, whatever it has given you, and to be the person you are. And as he points out, theater is one of the places where being yourself, we're calling it being open, being truthful, letting your real self show, is of value. And so the theater can give to everyone who gives themselves to it, to everyone who's able to give themselves to it, because not everybody can. The gift which Will demonstrates over and over and over again, the gift of not being at odds with yourself, the gift of being true to yourself. And when you can do that, then you can have the live, live, live. You can have the joy of life. That doesn't mean, again, as Will points out so poignantly, that doesn't mean there isn't any darkness or any sadness or any pain. It doesn't mean that there isn't work to do. And of course, as a therapist, that is what I do. I devote my work to helping people regain what Will has, and what he has clearly striven to hold on to. And that is your real self, your all of you. Why not take all of you? The good, what you have come to see as good or bad or problematic or acceptable or not. So Will, thank you for being yet another person who demonstrates what I hope this show is demonstrating. And as always, I hope that as you have listened, you have thought, is there a part of me that I learned so early on in my life was unacceptable or ugly or even dangerous to my comfort, my joy, my life? And did I deny it? Did I choose, which is in so many cases the best and most self-protective choice, did I choose to bury that thing about myself deep inside of myself, so deep that I forgot I had it? And am I spending energy still trying to keep it down, as I call it, undercover? Am I still presenting a cover story which is only part of the reality of myself? And are there ways in which, if I could surface those parts of myself, that my life would be fuller, more joyful, more mine? So if that has occurred to you, and you want to explore that more in a healthy and safe environment, you can go to my website and click on those podcasts that speak to that. The ones that say cover story, undercover, catastrophic expectations, family pie. You can get my book, When You Can, You Will, which talks about all of this and what to do about it. You can email me with any questions that you have. You can explore the possibility of doing psychotherapy on the phone, which is what I now do. And all of those things can be done on my website, thelynshow.com. thelynneshow. Don't leave the E out of Lynn. There are now a number of the Lynn shows in various variations. Also, if you have any issues with recording, electronics, computers, then you want Josh Hackney, who is the guy who shepherds me through all of the things I have to learn to do this show. And as you heard, I have technologically, I mean, I just forget to turn the recorder back on. That's how inadequate I am. And so without Josh, I'm not sure how I would do this show. So if you want any of those, help with any of those things, you want Josh, and you can get him as well on my website, thelynshow.com. And so now, as always, I hope you got something you can use from this show. Something that reminded you about yourself. Something that amused you or interested you. Or made you want to come down and see the Savannah Disputation. something that'll bring you back, because I'll be back next week, same station, same time. And I hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that grave.